Have you ever had a nightmare neighbor? You know, a neighbor from hell? You know what I'm talking about. If so, we want to hear about it in our brand new podcast, Nightmare Neighbors. That's right. We got another one in the works. But we need your stories first. Go to NightmareNeighbors.com and send in your nightmare neighbor story. Or call in toll-free 888-68-CRAZY. 888-68-CRAZY. And share your nightmare neighbor story with us. And we may talk about it and use it on a future episode of the Nightmare Neighbors podcast coming very soon. Maybe they're your current neighbors. Maybe they were a neighbor from years gone by. Now is the chance to tell your story anonymously. Go to NightmareNeighbors.com to share your nightmare neighbor story with us. Or call 888-68-CRAZY. And be part of the brand new Nightmare Neighbors podcast. What started out as a normal day in an otherwise normal northern town would turn into anything but, as an incident involving two ships on the town's integral waterway would end up maiming and killing countless residents in this town after a massive explosion. This is the story of the Halifax explosion, today on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
The Halifax explosion was a disaster that occurred in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, on the morning of December 6, 1917. SS Mont Blanc, a French cargo ship laden with high explosives, collided with the Norwegian vessel SS Emo in the Narrows, a strait connecting the upper Halifax harbor to Bedford Basin. A fire on board the French ship ignited her cargo, causing a massive explosion that devastated the Richmond district of Halifax. Approximately 2,000 people were killed by the blast. Debris, fires, collapsed buildings, and an estimated 9,000 others were injured. The blast was the largest man-made explosion at the time, releasing the equivalent of roughly 2.9 kilotons of TNT. Mont Blanc was under orders from the French government to carry her cargo from New York City to Halifax to Bordeaux, France. At roughly 8:45 a.m., she collided at low speed, approximately 1 knot, with the unladen Emu, chartered by Commission for Relief in Belgium to pick up a cargo of relief supplies in New York. On the Mont Blanc, the impact damaged benzol barrels stored on deck, leaking vapors which were ignited by sparks from the collision, setting off a fire on board that quickly grew out of control. Approximately 20 minutes later, at 9:04 a.m., the Mont Blanc exploded. Nearly all structures within an 800-meter, half-mile radius, including the community of Richmond, were obliterated. A pressure wave snapped trees, bent iron rails, demolished buildings, grounded vessels, including Emo, which was washed ashore by the ensuing tsunami, and scattered fragments of Mont Blanc for kilometers across the harbor in Dartmouth, where there was also widespread damage. A tsunami created by the blast wiped out the community of Mikarmk First Nation, who had lived in the Tufts Cove area for generations. Relief efforts began almost immediately, and hospitals quickly became full. Rescue trains began arriving the day of the explosion from across Nova Scotia to New Brunswick, while other trains from central Canada and northern United States were impeded by blizzards. Construction of temporary shelters to house the many people left homeless began soon after the disaster. The initial judicial inquiry found Mount Blanc to have been responsible for the disaster, but a later appeal determined that both vessels were to blame. In the North End, there are several memorials to the victims of the explosion on that fateful day in Halifax. So this is a very interesting story, one that I did not know anything about until roughly 10 years ago. Did you?
No, I'd never heard of it until we were there.
No. So almost 10 years to the day is when we learned about it. It was about next week or so is when we were on our honeymoon. And we took our honeymoon up into that area because we thought, why not go to places of major tragedies while you're celebrating your marriage?
Not exactly what we had planned, but we did find out about this.
Yeah, so we went to Halifax. We took a cruise, and it was a Canadian cruise, and it went to several places in Canada along that area of the shoreline, one of them being Halifax. And actually, we were interested in the Titanic Museum that was there and seeing the graveyard where many of the victims of Titanic were laid to rest.
And the pieces that were pulled out of the water from the ship and everything.
And this, in its own morbid, horrible, horrible, sad way, was the added bonus that we learned about that day at that museum, because half the museum is dedicated to Titanic and other shipwrecks of the area. And then the other half of the museum is dedicated to this. And I think I first learned about it when we were like, I think it was we were on the bus or something, and they're like, and right out there in that harbor is where the Mont Blanc exploded. And we're like, what?
Yeah.
And then we started learning more and more. I was like, holy shit, like this was a massive tragedy. 2,000 people died almost instantly. It was like a nuclear bomb going off.
Yeah.
In 1917, and this, for some reason, didn't seem to make the U.S. history books very much, or the you know, like, or at least the ones that we had in elementary school. But oh my God, yeah, I mean, just utter devastation. If you look at the pictures, I mean, it does. I mean, the only thing I can compare it to would be like either like Nagasaki after the war, or places ravaged by a tsunami or a hurricane, like a category 5, where everything is gone. That's what it looked like. But quite obviously having an impact on that town and that city for many years to come.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that, because there were still quite, you know, numerous old buildings in the area. So had nobody said anything, we wouldn't have known that anything had ever happened, you know, just because I guess everything was post, you know, 1917, which is still very old. But I had never heard of that. I'd heard of the Texas City explosion, which is similar, but not this one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, wasn't part of it that we saw, with maybe I'm wrong on this, and if I am, I'm sorry, but the hill, because it's kind of a mountainous, hillish region on the edge there. The hill kind of stopped a lot. I mean, whatever was on that hill was destroyed, which was part of the town. But then anything on the other part of the hill, I believe, survived, because the hill, like the explosion, you know, it kind of dampened it. And I think the area where we saw a lot of the buildings was actually other side of town, where it wasn't like in direct ground zero of the explosion. Isn't that correct?
I honestly don't remember.
Okay. I thought that's how it went. I could be wrong.
Okay.
But I believe that that's how, like, part of the town is still standing in buildings older than 1917, but then the other half, everything is post, because everything was gone.
Yeah.
But very interesting. Obviously, that's why we're making it one of the topics of the dark side of Wikipedia. So you too can learn the magic of the Halifax explosion. And yeah, just a horrible, horrible story. Let's continue on learning about what happened back in 1917 in Halifax. Dartmouth lies on the east shore of Halifax Harbor, and Halifax is on the west shore. By 1917, Halifax's inner harbor had become a principal assembly point for merchant convoys leaving for Britain and France. Halifax and Dartmouth had thrived during times of war. The harbor was one of the British Royal Navy's most important bases in North America, a center for wartime trade, and a home to privateers who harried the British Empire's enemies during the American Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars, and the War of 1812. The completion of the Intercontinental Railway and the Deep Water Terminal in 1880 allowed for increased steamship trade and led to accelerated development of the port area. But Halifax faced an economic downturn in the 1890s as local factories lost ground to competitors in central Canada. The British garrison left the city in late 1905 and early 1906. The Canadian government took over the Halifax Dockyard, now CFB Halifax, from the Royal Navy. This dockyard later became the command center of the Royal Canadian Navy upon its founding in 1910, just before the First World War. The Canadian government began a determined, costly effort to develop the harbor and waterfront facilities. The outbreak of the war brought Halifax back to prominence, as the Royal Canadian Navy had virtually no seaworthy ships of its own. The Royal Navy assumed responsibility for maintaining Atlantic trade routes by re-adopting Halifax as its North American base of operations. In 1915, management of the harbor fell under the control of the Royal Canadian Navy under the supervision of Captain Superintendent Edward Harrington Martin. By 1917, there was a growing naval fleet in Halifax, including patrol ships, tugboats, and minesweepers. The population of Halifax, Dartmouth had increased to between 60,000 to 65,000 people by 1917. Convoys carried men, animals, and supplies to the European Theater of War. The two main points of departure were in Nova Scotia at Sydney and Cape Breton Island in Halifax. Hospital ships brought the wounded to the city, and a new military hospital was constructed in the city. The success of the German U-boat attacks on ships crossing the Atlantic Ocean led the Allies to institute a convoy system to reduce losses while transporting goods and soldiers to Europe. Merchant ships gathered at Bedford Basin on the northwestern end of the harbor, which was protected by two sets of anti-submarine nets and guarded by a patrol of ships of the Royal Canadian Navy. The convoys departed under the protection of British cruisers and destroyers. A large army garrison protected the city with forts, gun batteries, anti-submarine nets, and more. These factors drove a major military, industrial, and residential expansion of the city, and the weight of goods passing through the harbor increased nearly ninefold. All neutral ships bound for ports in North America were required to report to Halifax for inspection. The Norwegian ship SS Emu had sailed from the Netherlands en route in New York to take on relief supplies for Belgium under the command of Haken Form. The ship arrived in Halifax on the 3rd of December for neutral inspection and spent 2 days in Bedford Basin awaiting refueling supplies. Though given clearance to leave the port on the 5th of December, Emu's departure was delayed because her coal load did not arrive until late that afternoon. The loading of fuel was not completed until after the anti-submarine nets had been raised for the night. Therefore, the vessel could not weigh anchor until the next morning. The French cargo ship SS Mont Blanc arrived from New York late on the 5th of December under the command of Amy D. Medic. The vessel was fully loaded with the explosives TNT and picric acid, a highly flammable fuel, benzoil, and gun cotton. She intended to join a slow convoy gathering in Bedford Basin, readying to depart for Europe, but was too late to enter the harbor before the nets were raised. Ships carrying dangerous cargo were not allowed into the harbor before the war, but the risk posed by German submarines had resulted in the relaxation of regulations. Navigating into or out of Bedford Basin required passage through a strait called the Narrows. Ships were expected to keep close to the side of the channel situated on their starboard, pass oncoming vessels port to port, that is to keep them on their left side. Ships were restricted to a speed of 5 knots within the harbor. Emu was granted clearance to leave Bedford Basin by signals from the guard ship HMCS Acadia at approximately 7:30 in the morning of the 6th of December, with pilot William Hayes on board. The ship entered the Narrows well above the harbor speed limit in an attempt to make up for the delay experienced in loading her coal. IMO met American tramp steamer SS Clara being piloted up the wrong western side of the harbor. The pilots agreed to pass starboard. Soon afterwards, IMO was forced to head even further toward the Dartmouth shore after passing the tugboat Stella Maris, which was traveling up the harbor to Bedford Basin near mid-channel. Horatio Brannan, the captain of Stella Maris, saw IMO approaching at excessive speed and ordered his ship closer to the western shore to avoid an accident. Francis Mackey, an experienced harbor pilot, had boarded Mont Blanc on the evening of the 5th of December, 1917. He had asked about special protections, such as a guard ship, given the Mont Blanc's cargo, but no protections were put in place. Mont Blanc started moving at 7:30 a.m. on December 6th and was the second ship to enter the harbor as the anti-submarine net between George's Island and Pier 21 opened for the morning. The Mont Blanc headed towards Bedford Basin on the Dartmouth side of the harbor. Mackey kept his eye on the ferry traffic between Halifax and Dartmouth and other small boats in the area. He first spotted IMO when she was about 0.75 miles away and became concerned as her path appeared to be heading towards the ship's starboard side as if to cut him off. Mackey gave a short blast of his ship's signal whistle to indicate that he had the right of way, but was met with two short blasts from IMO indicating that the approaching vessel would not yield its position. The captain ordered Mont Blanc to halt her engines and angle slightly starboard closer to the Dartmouth side of the Narrows. He let out another signal blast from his whistle, hoping the other vessel would likewise move to starboard, but was again met with a double blast. Sailors on nearby ships heard the series of signals and, realizing that a collision was imminent, gathered to watch as IMO bore down on Mont Blanc. Both ships had cut their engines by this point, but their momentum carried them right on top of each other at slow speed. Unable to ground his ship for fear of shock that would set off his explosive cargo, Mackey ordered Mont Blanc to steer hard to port, starboard helm, and cross the bow of IMO in a last-second bid to avoid a collision. The two ships were almost parallel to each other when IMO suddenly set out three signal blasts indicating the ship was reversing its engines. The combination of the cargo-less ship's height in the water and the transverse thrust of her right-hand propeller caused the ship's head to swing into Mont Blanc. IMO's prow pushed into the number one hold of Mont Blanc on her starboard side. The collision occurred at 8:45 a.m. The damage to Mont Blanc was not severe, but barrels of deck cargo toppled and broke open. This flooded the deck with benzol that quickly flowed into the hold as IMO's engines kicked in. She disengaged, which created sparks inside Mont Blanc's hull. These ignited the vapors from the benzol. The fire started at the waterline and traveled quickly up the side of the ship, surrounded by thick black smoke. And fearing she would explode almost immediately, the captain ordered the crew to abandon ship. A growing number of Halifax citizens gathered on the streets or stood at the windows of their homes or businesses to watch the spectacular fire. The frantic crew of the Mont Blanc shouted from their two lifeboats to some of the other vessels that their ship was about to explode, but they could not be heard above the noise and confusion. As the lifeboats made their way across the harbor to the Dartmouth shore, the abandoned ship continued to drift and beached herself at Pier 6 near the foot of Richmond Street. Towing two scows at the time of the collision, Stella Maris responded immediately to the fire, anchoring the barges and steaming back towards Pier 6 to spray the burning ship with their fire hose. The tug's captain, Horatio H. Brannan, and his crew realized that the fire was too intense for their single horse and backed off from the burning Mont Blanc. They were approached by a whaler from HMS High Flyer and later a steam pinnacle belonging to HMCS Nibel. Captain Brennan and Albert Madison and Nibel agreed to secure a line to the French ship's stern so as to pull it away from the pier to avoid setting it on fire. The 5-inch hawser initially produced was deemed too small and ordered for a 10-inch hawser came down. It was at this point that the blast occurred.
So they basically abandoned ship and just kind of let it drift as it was. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened.
They kind of knew what was going to happen, I think. Or did they think, that's my guess. Did they know it was going to happen? Or was it like a fear thing of like, let's get off the boats on fire?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that they knew that it was going to be as catastrophic as it was.
Yeah.
But it was probably the boat's going to blow up thing, yeah. But not just it's going to blow up, but it's also going to take out the town.
Yeah. That's what you wonder about is, had they known the devastation that it was about to cause, would they have stayed on board and tried to do whatever they could to put out the fire?
Yeah.
Because one could look at it and go, well, that was, you know, it was either selfish, you know, to get off the boat and just let it, you know, do what it's going to do. Or did they just not really understand the magnitude of what was going to happen? They thought, well, it'll blow up, but it'll just blow up and it'll sink and it's, you know,
and
end of story.
It's probably the latter, yeah. Honestly. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't think that they, you know, I think they thought they were just saving themselves, that nobody else was going to be hurt.
Mm-hmm. And it was just the boat that's going to go up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's quite a story of how all of that worked out to the point of the explosion then eventually happening right there in the bay. Let's continue on. At 9:04 a.m., the out-of-control fire on board Mont Blanc set off her cargo of high explosives. The ship was completely blown apart and a powerful blast wave radiated away from the explosion, initially more than 1,000 meters per second. Temperatures of 5,000 Celsius, that's 9,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and pressures of thousands of atmospheres accompanied the movement of detonation at the center of the explosion. White-hot shards of iron fell upon Halifax and Dartmouth. Mont Blanc's forward 90-millimeter gun laid approximately 5.6 kilometers north of the explosion site near Elbro Lake in Dartmouth, with its barrel melted away. And the shank of Mont Blanc's anchor, weighing half a ton, landed 3.2 kilometers, 2 miles south at Armdale. A cloud of white smoke rose to at least 36,000 meters. The shockwave from the blast traveled through the earth at nearly 23 times the speed of sound and was felt as far away as Cape Breton, nearly 129 miles away, and Prince Edward Island, 110 miles. An area of over 160 hectares, it's 400 acres, was completely destroyed by the explosion. And the harbor floor was momentarily exposed by the volume of water that was displaced. A tsunami was formed by water surging in to fill the void. It rose as high as 18 meters above the high water mark on the Halifax side of the harbor. Emu was carried onto the shore at Dartmouth by the tsunami. The blast killed all but one on the whaler, everyone on the Pinnacle, and 21 of the 26 men on Stella Maris. She ended up on the Dartmouth shore severely damaged. The captain's son, first mate Walter Brennan, who had been thrown into the hold by the blast, survived, as did four others. All but one of the Mont Blanc's crew survived. Over 1,600 people were killed instantly, and 9,000 were injured, more than 300 of whom later died. Every building within a 2.6-kilometer radius, so over 1.6 miles, over 12,000 in total, was destroyed or badly damaged. Hundreds of people who had been watching the fire from their homes were blinded when the blast wave shattered the windows in front of them. Stoves and lamps overturned by the force of the blast sparked fires throughout Halifax, particularly in the North End, where entire city blocks were caught up in the inferno, trapping residents inside their houses. Firefighter Billy Wells, who was thrown away from the explosion and had his clothes torn off his body, described the devastation survivors face. The sight was awful, with people hanging out of windows dead, some of their heads missing, some thrown onto the overhead telegraph wires. He was the only member of the 8-man crew of the fire engine Patricia to survive. Large brick and stone factories near Pier 6, such as the Acadia Sugar Refinery, disappeared into unrecognizable heaps of rubble, killing most of their workers. The Nova Scotia cotton mill, located 1.5 kilometers from the blast, was destroyed by fire and the collapse of its concrete floors. The Royal Navy College of Canada building was badly damaged and several cadets and instructors maimed. The Richmond Railway Yards and Station were destroyed, killing 55 railway workers and destroying and damaging over 500 railway cars. The North Street Station, one of the busiest in Canada, was badly damaged. The death toll could have been worse had it not been for the self-sacrifice of an intercolonial railway dispatcher, Patrick Vincent Coleman, operating at the rail yard about 750 feet from Pier 6 where the explosion occurred. He and his co-worker, William Lovett, learned of the dangerous cargo on board the burning Mont Blanc from a sailor and began to flee. Coleman remembered that an incoming passenger train from St. John, New Brunswick, was due to arrive at the rail yard within minutes. He returned to his post alone and continued to send out urgent telegraph messages to stop the train. Several variations of the message have been reported, among them this from the Maritime Museum of the Atlantic: "Hold up the train, ammunition ship afire in harbor, making for Pier 6 and will explode. Guess this will be my last message. Goodbye, boys." Coleman's message was responsible for bringing all incoming trains around Halifax to a halt. It was heard by other stations all along the Intercolonial Railway, helping railway officials to respond immediately. Passenger train number 10, the overnight train from St. John, is believed to have heeded the warning and stopped a safe distance from the blast at Rockingham, saving the lives of about 300 railway passengers. Coleman was killed at his post as the explosion ripped through the city. He was honored with a Heritage Minute in the 1990s, inducted into the Canadian Railway Hall of Fame in 2004, and a new Halifax-Dartmouth ferry was named for him in 2018. First rescue efforts came from surviving neighbors and co-workers who pulled the dugout victims from buildings. The initial informal response was soon joined by surviving policemen, firefighters, and military personnel who began to arrive, as did anyone with a working vehicle. Cars, trucks, and delivery wagons, all kinds of vehicles were enlisted to collect the wounded. The flood of victims soon began to arrive at the city's hospitals, which were quickly overwhelmed. The new military hospital, Camp Hill, admitted approximately 1,400 victims on December 6. Firefighters were among the first to respond to the disaster, rushing to Mont Blanc to attempt to extinguish the blaze before the explosion even occurred. They also played a role after the blast, with fire companies arriving to assist from across Halifax, and by the end of the day, as far as Amherst, Nova Scotia, approximately 120 miles, and Moncrinton, New Brunswick, about 160 miles, on relief trains. Halifax Fire Department's West Street Station 2 was the first to arrive at Pier 6 with the crew of the Patricia, the first motorized fire engine in Canada. In the final moments before the explosion, hoses were being unrolled as the fire spread to the docks. Nine members of the Halifax Fire Department lost their lives performing their duty that day. Royal Navy cruisers in port sent some of the first organized rescue parties ashore, HMS High Flyer, along with the armed merchant cruisers HMS Knight Templar and HMS Calgarin, sent boats ashore with rescue parties and medical personnel and soon began to take wounded aboard. A U.S. Coast Guard cutter, the USRC Morrill, sent a rescue party ashore. Out at sea, the American cruiser USS Tacoma and our merchant cruiser USS Von Steuben, formerly another ship, were passing Halifax en route to the United States. Tacoma was rocked so severely by the blast wave that her crew went to general quarters. Spotting the large and rising column of smoke, Tacoma alerted altered course and arrived to assist the rescue at 2 p.m. Von Steuben arrived a half hour later. The American steamship Old Colony, docked in Halifax for repairs, suffered little damage and was quickly converted to serve as a hospital ship, staffed by doctors and orderlies from the British and American Navy vessels in the harbor. Dazed survivors immediately feared that the explosion was the result of a bomb dropped from a German plane. Troops and gun battles and barracks immediately turned out in case the city was under attack, but within an hour switched from defense to rescue roles as the cause and location of the explosion were determined. All available troops were called in from harbor fortifications and barracks to the north end to rescue survivors and provide transportation to the city's hospitals, including two army hospitals in the city. Adding to the chaos were the fears of a potential second explosion. A cloud of steam shot out of ventilators at the ammunition magazine at Wellington Barracks as naval personnel extinguished a fire by the magazine. The fire was quickly put out. The cloud was seen from blocks away and quickly led to rumors that another explosion was imminent. Uninformed officers ordered everyone away from the area. As the rumor spread across the city, many families fled their homes. The confusion hampered efforts for over 2 hours until fears were dispelled by about noon. Many rescuers ignored the evacuation and naval rescue parties continued working uninterrupted at the harbor. Surviving railway workers in the rail yards at the heart of the disaster carried out rescue work, pulling people from the harbor and from under debris. The overnight train from St. John was just approaching the city when hit by the blast, but was only slightly damaged. It continued into Richmond until the track was blocked by wreckage. Passengers and soldiers aboard used the emergency tools from the train to dig people out of the houses and bandage them with sheets from the sleeping cars. The train was loaded with injured and left the city at 1:30 with a doctor on board to evacuate the wounded to Truro. Led by Lieutenant Governor McCollum Grant, leading citizens formed the Halifax Relief Commission at around noon. The committee organized members in charge of organizing medical relief for both Halifax and Dartmouth, supplying transportation, food and shelter, and covering medical and funeral costs for victims. The commission would continue until 1976, participating in reconstruction and relief efforts and later distributing pensions to survivors. Men and women turned out to serve as everything from hospital aides to shelter staff, while children contribute to the relief effort by carrying messages from site to site. Rescue trains were dispatched from across Atlantic Canada as well as the northeastern United States. The first left the area around 10 a.m. carrying medical personnel and supplies, arriving in Halifax by noon and returned to Truro with the wounded and homeless by 3 p.m. The track had become impassable after Rockingham on the western edge of Bedford Basin. To reach the wounded, rescue personnel had to walk through parts of the devastated city until they reached a point where the military had begun to clear the streets. By nightfall, dozens of trains had reached Halifax from Nova Scotian towns. Relief efforts were hampered the following day by a blizzard that blanketed Halifax with 16 inches of heavy snow. Trains en route from other parts of Canada and the United States were stalled in snowdrifts, and telegraph lines that had been hastily repaired following the explosion were again knocked down. Halifax was isolated by the storm, and rescue communities were forced to suspend the search for survivors. The storm aided efforts to put out fires throughout the city, though. Destruction and loss of life was massive. The exact number killed by the disaster is still unknown. The Halifax Explosion Remembrance Book, an official database compiled in 2002 by the Nova Scotia Archives and Records Management, identified 1,950 victims. As many as 1,600 people died immediately in the blast and tsunami and collapse of buildings. The last body, a caretaker killed at the exhibition grounds, was not recovered until the summer of 1919. An additional 9,000 injured, 1,630 homes were destroyed in the explosion and fires, and another 12,000 damaged. Roughly 6,000 people were left homeless, and 25,000 had insufficient shelter. The city's industrial sector was in large part gone, with many workers among the casualties, and the dockyard heavily damaged.
I was reading that by far the most common injury was to the eyes.
Sure.
Do you know why that is?
Because of the light of the explosion or not, the chemicals?
Not exactly. Because the initial fire drew everybody to watch it out their windows.
Okay.
And being up on a hill like that, everybody could see out to the harbor.
Mm.
So everybody was looking out their windows when the explosion happened. So most people lost eyes to glass and the glare, you know, or their eyes were burned by the brightness.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought it was stunning that the tsunami from this explosion, 60 feet high.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and the fact that it temporarily showed the bottom of the water. Mm-hmm. The ground was exposed because it blew up that much. I mean, that's just, I mean, could you imagine? Today we have viral videos. Today we have all of these horrible, horrible things that we're able to witness in real time. I mean, I'm thinking of the tsunamis and stuff that we see where it's like water's coming in, water's coming in, that we've seen in several countries. Could you imagine what the video would look like of this?
No.
If it were around, I mean, it would be like, you know, it would be on level with that sort of stuff that you would see in Hollywood movies. And when it actually happens, you're like, oh, holy shit, this is actually happening.
But anybody that would be trying to get video of it, I think would have been lost, or their camera would have been destroyed. I don't know that there would have been any surviving video to have seen.
Yeah. I mean, unless it was like in the air far away. But even then, the blast goes. I mean, so, I mean, airplanes really weren't a thing at this time, right? I mean,
no, they were. It's just they, you know, were not. I mean, this was World War One era. Yeah. This was not World War II, where everybody had planes by then.
Sure. So, I mean, the likelihood of there being a plane flying over at that moment in time, not super likely. But had there been, I wonder if that would have been affected by it, too, if it would have been, you know, affected by the blast wave.
Oh, sure, it would have. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just what an amazing, I mean, a horrible sight. But I mean, just to, if you could see that, that would just be mind blowing.
Yeah.
For what that was. Let's continue on with the last part of what happened here with the Halifax explosion. A mortuary committee chaired by Alderman R.B. Coldwell was quickly formed at Halifax City Hall on the morning of the disaster. The Chibuguto Rhodes School, now the Maritime Academy of Performing Arts in Halifax's West End, was chosen as a central morgue. A company of the Royal Canadian Engineers repaired and converted the basement of the school to serve as a morgue and classrooms to serve as offices for the Halifax coroner. Trucks and wagons soon began to arrive with bodies. Coroner Arthur S. Barnstead took over from Coldwell as the morgue went into operation and implemented a system to carefully number and describe bodies. It was based on the system developed by his father, John Henry Barnstead, to identify Titanic victims in 1912. Many of the wounds inflicted by the blast were permanently debilitating, such as those caused by flying glass or by the flash of the explosion. Thousands of people had stopped to watch the ship burning in the harbor, many from inside buildings, leaving them directly in the path of glass fragments from shattered windows. Roughly 59,000 eye injuries were reported. 41 people lost their sight permanently. An estimated $35 million in damage resulted. It would result in $591 million today. About $30 million in financial aid was raised for various sources, including $18 million from the federal government, over $4 million from the British government, and $750,000 from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Dartmouth was not as densely populated as Halifax and was separated by the blast by the width of the harbor, but still suffered heavy damage. About 100 people were estimated to have died on the Dartmouth side. Windows were shattered, and many buildings were damaged or destroyed, including the Olin Brewery and parts of the Star Manufacturing Company. Nova Scotia Hospital was the only hospital in Dartmouth, and many of the victims were treated there. McComb settlements, there were several enclaves of them around the coves of the Bedford Basin on the Dartmouth side, directly opposed to Pier 9 on the Halifax side, set a community in Tufts Cove, known as Turtle Grove. The settlement dating back to the 18th century had been a subject of controversy because white settler landowners wanted to remove these residents. In the years and months preceding the explosion, the Department of Indian Affairs had been actively trying to force them to give up their land, but this had not occurred by the time of the explosion. The fire aboard the Mont Blanc drew the attention of many onlookers on both sides of the harbor. The physical structures of the settlement were obliterated by the explosion and the subsequent tsunami. A precise death toll is unknown. Records show that 9 bodies were recovered, and the settlement was not rebuilt in the wake of the disaster. The Halifax Remembrance Book lists 16 members of the Tufts Cove community as dead, Not all the dead listed as a Tough Cove were indigenous. Survivors were housed in a racially segregated building under generally poor conditions and eventually dispersed around Nova Scotia. The black community of Africville on the southern shores of Bedford Basin, adjacent to the Halifax Peninsula, was spared the direct force of the blast by the shadow effect of the rised ground to the south. Africville's small and frail homes were heavily damaged by the explosion. Families recorded the deaths of five residents due to a combination of persistent racism and growing conviction that Africville should be demolished to make way for industrial development. The people of Africville received no police or fire protection and had to make do without water mains and sewer lines despite paying city taxes. Africville received little of the donated relief funds and none of the progressive reconstruction invested in other parts of the city after the explosion. Many people in Halifax first believed the explosion to be a result of a German attack. The Halifax Herald continued to propagate this belief for some time. For example, reporting that Germans had mocked victims of the explosion, while John Johansson, the Norwegian helmsman of Imo, was being treated for serious injuries sustained during the explosion, it was reported to the military police that he had been behaving suspiciously. Johansson was arrested on suspicion of being a German spy when a search turned up a letter on his person supposedly written in German. It turned out that the letter was actually written in Norwegian. Immediately following the explosion, most of the German survivors in Halifax had been rounded up and imprisoned. Eventually, the fear dissipated as the real cause of the explosion became known, although rumors of German involvement persisted. A judicial inquiry known as the Wreck Commissioner's Inquiry was formed to investigate the causes of the collision. Proceedings began at the Halifax Courthouse on the 13th of December, 1917, presided over by Justice Arthur Drysdale. The inquiry's report of on the 4th of February 1918 blamed Mont Blanc's captain, the ship's pilot, and the commander of the Royal Canadian Navy's chief examining officer in charge of the harbor, gates, and anti-submarine defenses for causing the collision. Drysdale agreed with Dominion Wreck Commissioner L.A. Demir's opinion that it was the Mont Blanc's responsibility alone to ensure that she avoided a collision at all costs given her cargo. He was likely influenced by local opinion, which was strongly anti-French, as well as by the street fighter style argumentation used by Imo lawyers Charles Burchell. According to Crown Counsel W.A. Henry, this was a great surprise to most people who had expected the Imo to be blamed for being in the wrong side of the channel. All three men were charged with manslaughter and criminal negligence by a preliminary hearing heard by Stipendiary Magistrate Richard A. McLeod and bound over for trial. And Nova Scotia Supreme Court Justice Benjamin Russell found there was no evidence to support any of these charges. Mackey was discharged on a writ of habeas corpus and the charges were dropped. Charges against Lee Medic were also dismissed. This left only Wyatt to face a grand jury hearing on the 17th of April, 1918. A jury acquitted him in the trial that lasted less than a day. Drysdale also oversaw the first civil litigation trial in which the owners of the two ships sought damages from each other. His decision found Mont Blanc entirely at fault. Subsequent appeals to the Supreme Court of Canada and the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council in London determined Mont Blanc and Imo were equally to blame for navigational errors that led to the collision. No party was ever convicted for any crime or otherwise successfully prosecuted for any actions that precipitated the disaster. Efforts began shortly after the explosion to clear debris, repair buildings, and establish temporary housings for survivors left homeless by the explosion. In late January 1918, around 5,000 were still without shelter. A reconstruction committee under Colonel Robert Lowe constructed 832 new housing units, which were furnished by the Massachusetts Halifax Relief Fund. Partial train service resumed from a temporary rail terminal in the city's south end on the 7th of December. Full service resumed on the 9th of December when tracks were cleared and the Northern Street Station reopened. The Canadian Government Railways created a special unit to clear and repair railway yards as well as rebuild railway piers at the naval dockyards. Most piers returned to operation by late December and were repaired by January. The North End Halifax neighborhood of Richmond bore the brunt of the explosion. In 1917, Richmond was considered a working-class neighborhood and had few paved roads. After the explosion, the Halifax Relief Commission approached the reconstruction of Richmond as an opportunity to improve and modernize the city's North End. English town planner Thomas Adams and Montreal architectural firm Ross and MacDonald were recruited to design a new housing plan for Richmond. Adams, inspired by the Victorian Garden City movement, aimed to provide public access to green spaces and to create a low-rise, low-density, and multifunctional urban neighborhood. The planners designed 326 large homes that each faced a tree-lined paved boulevard. They specified that the homes be built with a new and innovative fireproof material, blocks of compressed cement called hydrostone. The first of these homes was occupied by March of 1919. Once finished, the hydrostone neighborhood consisted of homes, businesses, and parks, which helped create a new sense of community in the north end of Halifax. It's now become an upscale neighborhood and shopping district. In contrast, the equally poor, underdeveloped area of Africville was not included in reconstruction efforts. Every building in the Halifax Dockyard required some degree of rebuilding, as did HMCS Noble and the docks themselves. All of the Royal Canadian Navy's minesweepers and patrol boats were undamaged. Prime Minister Robert Borden pledged that the government would be cooperating in every way to reconstruct the Port of Halifax. This was of utmost importance to the Empire. Captain Sigmonton of USS Tacoma speculated that the port would not be operational for months, but a convoy departed on 11th of December. Dockyard operations resumed before Christmas.
That's kind of amazing to me that this happened on the 6th and they, you know, were able to get it back and running by Christmas.
Yeah, in that year. Mm-hmm. I mean, without modern technology.
Yeah.
They were able to get all of these things done and deal with all of the death. And, you know, I mean, because you got to think when that happens too, you've lost a ton of people in the chain of whatever command you normally would have.
Yeah.
And people in the chain of manufacturing things and constructing things and all this. And it's like, I don't know that today anything like that could be done. I don't know that we're capable of it, quite honestly.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the will of people in that time is probably greater than the will of the people now.
The ingenuity.
And I hate to say that because we're living now, we're part of that society, but the things that they were able to accomplish during dire times in those days were just stuff that we can't wrap our mind around because that's not something that is done now.
It's not been done for the most part in our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. You know, 9/11, a lot of people rallied around everything and we felt like closer as a nation in the United States. But, you know, I mean, it wasn't like, oh, and the local people can go rebuild a building. I mean, that took a lot of time because it involved a lot of planning and there's a lot that was involved and it took almost 10 years.
Yeah.
For that building to come back up.
Well, it took years just to clear the site.
Yeah. But it's interesting, and that's not, I'm not criticizing that at all. I'm just saying it's very different today how things operated back then. Is there more red tape today just to do anything, even in the wake of tragedies, you think, versus back then where it's like, we got to do this now, let's do it?
Well, I think back then it was more like in this case, you know, this happened in the middle of winter in Canada. Or, you know, the very beginning of winter in Canada. And it's a matter of we have to get this done or we're not going to survive the winter. But also, you know, there probably weren't any codes that needed to be followed.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, regulation on what you do with all the debris and the remnants, you know. And so, yeah, there's a lot more red tape for good reason now.
Yeah.
And that's part of what slows it down. But just I think still the will and the drive to get things back operating, you know, I think had that happened now, you know, there'd be a period of mourning that would go on before people would even consider trying to
get it going
again.
Yeah, it was a different way of thinking. I think it was more of a survivalist world.
They couldn't afford to mourn.
There wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, mourning obviously is something nobody, you know, it's necessary, but it's not something that anyone, you know, likes to do. But that wasn't a luxury to them. No. It wasn't an option.
Right.
It was simply, these are people that came from a world of survival. Things were starting to get somewhat modernized into the world of that time, but they still knew the world of survival and living off of whatever means they had. And they were able to take those skills and implement them in such a fast way. And everybody worked together somewhat to get things kind of going. Mm-hmm. It is interesting though, we still in our society had tons of racial problems, it sounded like, obviously we heard about there, the African, little Africa area or what was the town called?
Africtown.
And so there was obviously, they had racial injustices going on there, but it also sounded like other races as well. They rounded up all the Germans in the town. Mm-hmm. It was like anybody we suspect might not be, you know, us,
yeah.
whoever is us, quote unquote, or the people in the right, you know, obviously that was still a horrible, horrible issue, you know, that then it never gets truly resolved. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there's differences to the society of that point in time, there are still a lot of similarities as well.
Exactly.
Which is very interesting when we look back at history and try and take everything into context of, how were people thinking at the time? Why were they thinking the way they were thinking? What was going on? What was their upbringing? What were they surrounded by? What were they skilled in? What were they not skilled in? And you still have a lot of these things that are just still there, you know? Mm-hmm. It's, yeah. Well, that's going to wrap up this episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like the program, press subscribe, whatever platform it is you listen to us on, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We greatly appreciate it. Until next time, for The Dark Side of Wikipedia, for Jenny, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening.